WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today, the juxtaposition of two very different art forms, Opera Carolina and Opera Carolina's production of The Magic Flute and Mixed Martial Arts. Has there ever been such a meeting? I don't think so. So, we begin with Mozart's The Magic Flute. One of opera's most famous and popular overtures, The Magic Flute. Opera Carolina is bringing back this classic beginning January 19th, but with a twist, as they did with last year's Madama Butterfly. Again, the sets and costumes will be designed by famed visual artist June Kaneko, and although it won't look the same, there's that timeless music, and it will be sung by many, including our guests today. Una Lee plays Pamina, the daughter of the Queen of the Night. She joined us last year when she played the lead in Madama Butterfly. Good to see you again. Welcome back.
Thank you. Nice good to see you too.
Also with us is Sean Matthew, who plays the handsome prince, isn't there always one, Tamino, in this production of The Magic Flute. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Thank you.
And James Mina is with us too. He's Opera Carolina's general director and principal conductor.
Nice. Morning, Mike.
Nice to have
good
you
to
with
see
us.
See you again.
The Magic Flute's an opera that seems to cycle through fairly frequently with opera companies, including Opera Carolina, but this is a new production with sets and costumes, as I said, by June Kaneko, who was our guest last year. We had him on the program with Una Lee. Later on in a subsequent broadcast, you talked to me about how that was received, and some people, some opera aficionados, didn't care for the set very much. They were a little put off by it. But here you are again, doing it
exactly.
Again. So tell me why they were put off by it, and
well, Mike, I think the Butterfly production, you know, Madama Butterfly is such a specific period in time, specific style when you do it in traditional style that many of our more conservative audience members.
You should see his face.
We're a little taken aback by the fact that Jeune infused it with this very interesting concept, which really the vast majority of the audience loved it and thought it was terrific. It's a very different animal with The Magic Flute, because we've seen productions of The Magic Flute in outer space, in every different possible configuration. And so I don't think audiences are as married
right.
to the traditional presentation of The Magic Flute as other operas.
You're 9 days out from opening. It opens on January 19th at the Belk. And I'm just curious, I know how theater works, but I don't know how opera works necessarily. So where are you in the process of things?
The opera is almost completely staged with the principals and the chorus, which is great. But this opera production is so highly technical that the real difficulties are going to be ahead of us. There are more than a dozen extras, supernumeraries, who do things from carrying on the water in the padlock to moving furniture to manipulating a 20-foot-tall serpent, two-headed serpent, doesn't look like a Chinese dragon, but it's similar in style.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're the ones who really have the bulk of the rehearsal. They had a 3-hour rehearsal last night, another 3-hour rehearsal tonight, just on all of the nuances and the difficulties that they have to go through. Then we get into the theater, because this production is predicated on 8 high-end digital projections. There are more than 1,000 digital images that basically begin at the overture and run through the entire piece, changing the look of the stage constantly during the evening.
Where do the projections live?
They're actually all over the theater. Four of them are in the back of the house. We had to remove two rows of seats in the very back of the main floor. Some of them are positioned up in the boxes.
These are the projectors?
The projectors.
Okay, but where are you? What are you projecting onto, I guess?
The flat surfaces.
Okay.
They're
all over the stage.
A number of flat surfaces on the stage, which some of them move in and out during the course of the evening in order to create different looks on stage.
This is high tech.
This is extremely high tech. It's Broadway, I've never quite honestly seen a production quite like this that takes you on a visual journey from beginning to end, 3 hours, including the intermission. It's really absolutely brilliant.
Now, both our other guests, Una Lee and Sean Matthey, have done, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you have done this. This is a co-production with the San Francisco Opera and the Washington Opera, Washington, D.C. Opera, and you've done this production before, correct?
I have not sung this particular production. I've done Magic Flute a lot.
Okay.
But this is the first time I've done this production.
But
this is new for the entire cast, particular production.
None
of our cast were in San Francisco.
Not this production, but I've sung Pamina one time before.
Oh, okay. So this is going to be a whole new experience. When you've done something like this so many times before, because opera singers, by the very nature of their work, have to have a certain amount of repertoire, and this is in your repertoire, so you've done it. Well, this is a whole different imagining of it. So what does that do to your head? Because you don't know yet, I don't think, what you're necessarily in for, do you?
We will never know because we will never be able to see the whole thing ourselves. But we've seen some videotapes, and it's just fantastic. I mean, I was enjoying so much last year, although some audience members were put off. I don't understand. But it was so strikingly beautiful visually.
Yes.
And I'm so looking forward to it.
So it doesn't really impact you? Is that what you're telling me? Because you can't see it? You just go where you're supposed to go and sing what you're supposed to sing, and whatever happens around you happens.
Yeah, I think that Tamino's mission or his core values, no matter what the concept of the production are, he has to convey the message of love and that he believes in love. And I think in particular this production, from what I've seen of it, mm-hmm. visually represented on the computer screen, it's only going to serve to enhance my ability to convey that message because it is so beautiful to look at.
So this is a co-production, as I said, with the San Francisco Opera and the mm-hmm. Washington Opera, and the San Francisco Chronicle lauded it for its explosively colorful stage design, which combines projected animations with vivid costumes. When you do a co-production like this, do you inherit more than the sets and the costumes? Do you inherit the director? Does he come with them and give you the...
Yes, in the agreement that we all came to at the very beginning, we agreed to either hire the stage director or an assistant. Uh-huh. So actually the originating stage director was not available for our period, so his assistant is here remounting the production for us. But you're basically agreeing to the lighting designer, the costume design, so that the integrity of the production stays intact through all the partner groups.
Is this a new way of doing business in the world of opera?
No. We've been doing this for decades. The Cold Sassy Tree that we did in 2003 uh-huh. with Houston and San Diego was the same type of thing. In the partnership agreement, you're agreeing to the designers and the directors so that, again, the production itself has integrity with all the partner groups.
Now, of course, San Francisco and Washington, D.C. are first-tier cities. And Charlotte, although we'd like to be, we're not there yet in terms of size of population or even people's thought process, although I'm sure the Democratic National Convention changed everything. So tell me about how this came to be, this partnership.
Well, Mike, it started off through a series of conversations with our partners here at Wells Fargo.
Oh.
Of course.
Based in San Francisco.
Which is based in San Francisco. So as Wachovia was going through the transition to become Wells Fargo, many of the senior leadership at Wachovia, of course, stayed and became Wells Fargo senior leadership. And a handful of them have been opera patrons and opera board members. So we started to think through, how do we then not only strengthen our branding collaboration with Wells Fargo now, but how do we add value to that? The general director in San Francisco is the former general director at Houston, who I knew through our collaboration of Cold Sassy Tree. So we started almost a two-year dialogue between Opera Carolina and San Francisco Opera on what kinds of projects make sense for the two cities and the two companies. And, of course, trying then to get Wells Fargo personnel from San Francisco and Charlotte involved in that creative collaborative process. So through all of those conversations came this idea of this new production of The Magic Flute, and then, of course, Washington Opera came on board, and and there we are.
So I mentioned that the sets may be different, the costumes may be different, the approach may be different this time around, but the music's always the same. It's Mozart. It's one of Mozart's most loved operas.
Amazing piece.
Why is it an amazing piece? That's my question. Why is it most loved? Why is it an amazing piece?
Well, it's beloved because the messaging, even though you can enjoy the piece without the messaging is profound. The comedy is as fresh in every production as it was 200 plus years ago. But I think the most amazing aspect of The Magic Flute, imagine an artist, a visual artist, who is given four colors, four primary colors, and told, create a masterpiece. And that's what Mozart did. He wrote in a very accessible musical language because he was writing for the folk. He was writing for the folk theater. He wasn't writing for the Imperial Court Theater.
So this would be, what's the word I'm looking for? If there's musical theater, this would be operetta.
This was very much the what would make that equation to. This was written as popular entertainment, even though it is a big, wonderful opera. Of course, when you've got a Mozart writing, it's going to come out as being just a piece of genius. But he was writing for the common man. Mm-hmm. He was not writing for the nobility.
And that's why it still resonates.
And that's why it still resonates. And this is a family opera. We're, of course, performing it in English. And kids just love it. Sean is bringing his wife and two daughters down from Northwest Ohio, and they can't wait.
Are you afraid you're going to influence your daughters in some way? Because we're going to talk about your musical influences in the next segment. But are you hopeful that they'll be influenced by seeing this?
I think the job has actually been deferred to the Queen of the Night because they've seen Magic Flute so many times, and that's their character. Those are the songs they sing, and actually pretty well and in key around the house.
Really?
Yeah.
How old are they?
4 and 8.
Of course, they get good training, don't they?
It's incredible. I mean, if I'm pushing one on the swing set at school and she'll just start singing, the 4-year-old will start singing Queen of Night in key, and it brings a smile to my face.
Now, you're returning here, Una, for the second time. I think your appearance here as Madame Butterfly was your first time in Charlotte. Where have you been and what have you done since?
Since that time, I've sung a few more butterflies, and I'm singing this Pamina this year. I mean, this month and next month, I will sing another Mozart in Nozze di Figaro. I'll be singing Countess. I'm excited. Singing two Mozarts back to back.
Both of you travel the world, literally the world, doing this. And when we, at the risk of having to cut you off in the middle of a sentence because we have to go to a break. I'm really curious about your lives. What kind of life is it? It's a suitcase life, isn't it?
It's fantastic.
You have a great Louis Vuitton suitcase. It's fantastic.
Oh, okay. I don't have that, but I'll call my husband.
We'll come back and talk more about that because we do have to take a break. And I also want to let folks hear you because we have some of your singing available to us, which is unusual, but we've got it and we'll play it when we come back. We're talking about Opera Carolina's production of The Magic Flute, which opens January 19th, runs the 19th, 24th, and 27th at the Belk Theater, with Sean Mathy, who plays Tamino, and Una Lee, who plays Pamina, and James Mina, who is the general director and principal conductor of Opera Carolina. Charlotte Talks on WFA.
Sarah
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Boatsman Gilmore Wagner, offering accounting, tax, and financial advisory services for local businesses with offices in the Charlotte and Huntersville Lake Norman areas. BoatsmanGilmoreWagner.com. And Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, treatment of spine and brain disorders for North Meck and Lake Norman residents at its Huntersville office. Neurosurgeons, physiatrists, and physical therapy. CarolinaNeurosurgery.com. Well, you of course know that former Nebraska Republican Senator Chuck Hagel was nominated by President Obama to be his next Secretary of Defense, and that is meeting some resistance among Republican members of the U.S. Senate who have to confirm that nomination. We spoke to the senator in 2008 just prior to the election. We repeat some of that broadcast tomorrow at 9 and then kind of analyze what's going on in Washington in the second part of the show. That's tomorrow.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, this year's flu season started early and is hitting hard. How it compares to previous years and what flu vaccines can and cannot do.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. James Mina, Una Lee, and Sean Matthey, three principal people involved in the upcoming production of The Magic Flute, Opera Carolina's Magic Flute, on January 19th, 24th, 27th at The Bill. For those of you who missed Una Lee last year in Madama Butterfly, I went to your website and found you singing Un Bel Di. Just a little piece of it on your website, which I've now edited for time, which I know in opera is a sin, but I wanted people to hear what they missed if they didn't catch you then and they don't catch you in The Magic Flute. I love to watch people who have performed and listen to themselves perform. Is it easy for you to listen to yourself?
It's a torture.
Because I was looking at your face and I was thinking, is she really into this, or is she just in pain listening to this?
Yes, I was in pain.
Why?
Just because you know yourself the best, so I know what I did, what I didn't, and I'm just busy analyzing everything. I can't enjoy.
What about you, Sean? You heard it. You're just passionate.
I was very much enjoying it. I was not tortured. I was loving it.
I read in an interview that you did in which you were asked about your time here in Charlotte last year in Butterfly, and you said you had a great time, and you added that that is not always the case when you travel around the world doing these things. You called this experience exceptional. Mm-hmm. Why?
I just fell in love with these people here, starting with James Mina. I mean, he's right here, so I can't really say. But this company was so wonderful to work with. Everybody was just sincerely nice, and I made friends with some of sponsors here, and they're just adorable people. And the way they treat us, it's just not just because of the business. It's just genuine and sincere. So I was so looking forward to being back here, and I'm having another great time here.
And that doesn't happen elsewhere?
Not always. I'm sorry, but not always the case.
What's the worst You have to tell me where it was, but when you think of it negatively about places you've been and people you've met, where's the
There's
word?
Some okay, some cities that I feel they feel like they don't appreciate us being there because they feel they are, I don't know how to say, better. a little, you know, arrogant feeling that you get from the company sometimes.
Is this in the U.S. or in Europe or Asia or where?
In the U.S.
In the U.S.? Okay, that's all right. In the Magic Flute, you play Pamina.
Yeah.
The woman, the handsome prince, Tamino, is trying to woo, and mm-hmm. Sean, that's your job. You've played this role before, with the San Francisco Opera and the English National Opera and the Paris Opera and the Dallas Opera and probably others. Is that correct?
That's right.
So talk to me about what you have to do, if anything, in terms of how you approach this role when you perform it with different productions in different cities with different music directors and different stage directors.
I think no matter what the concept, no matter what the scenic design, Tamino has to be true to the theme of his journey, that he represents love and he believes in love. And if you're not getting that message across through your 3 hours plus on the stage, you really have not succeeded in your job of singing Tamino. First, you have to sing it, of course. It's hard. But it has to have sincerity. It has to be real.
Now, there may be people out there who do not know the story of the Magic Flute. And like any, I think any piece of a dramatic production, whether it's a play or a musical or an opera, when you just go through what happens in the story, it can sometimes sound ludicrous,
right,
ridiculous. But at the risk of that, what's the plot?
Mike, in a nutshell, the plot is actually like most of Mozart's operas. You can really get lost in this plot. But you have this prince, Tamino, and this princess, Pamina, who are both searching not just for true love, but enlightenment. And, of course, this is an 18th century piece, the age of the Enlightenment, the age of equality for all men. So their journey is not just their personal search for true love and enlightenment, but it's also a statement about the state of humankind, that humankind can find true enlightenment and peace only through an equality and union of men and women. And that's really what's going on at the heart of the Magic
That's
Flute.
That's really way ahead of its time.
It is way ahead of its time.
How was it received by Mozart's audience in those times?
It was by the people. It was embraced because they understood what the messaging was. The nobility, because the Enlightenment was, of course, was disparaged and persecuted by the nobility, they didn't like this whatsoever, which is one of the reasons why it went to the Folk's Theater instead of the Imperial Theater.
Plus, there are a lot of Masonic themes because Mozart was a Mason.
Exactly.
And that was what regarded with, what, suspicion back then?
Great suspicion. Great suspicion back in the 18th century and all the way through the mid-19th century. Freemasonry was oppressed, particularly in Europe, by the nobility and by the Catholic Church, considered to be subversive. Which is why lots of the messaging in the Magic Flute is shrouded in symbols. So it's like you have to know what the code is in order to get the messaging. But the brilliant aspect of it, again, it's Mozart, is that you can enjoy this piece and not know any of that.
Okay.
Because it's an extraordinary piece. And we have the comic relief of Papageno, who is just a great entertainer.
Because you were asked in an interview that I read, Sean, what people should know if they've never seen this before they come. And you said nothing. Which I think is a great answer. What do you know about movies before you see them? Or a television show? Nothing.
I think that the genius of it is that you're going to experience it for the first time and you're going to have your reactions. It's going to spark something. Mm-hmm. And you don't need to know anything coming in because it's going to take you on a journey. It's going to take you where you need to go.
Now, again, we have a little piece of you singing your role of Tamino in Dallas with the Dallas Opera. And I apologize once again for the quality. This is the best we can do because we don't have access to your vast archive of audio
files.
That's
okay.
But we took this off. I took this off of YouTube.
Mm.
And it's obviously from a camera from the back of the house. Somebody, I don't know who did this. Do you know who did this?
I don't know. No, I don't know.
Do you know that it's on YouTube?
I didn't even know that.
Well, you're on YouTube.
Okay.
And so obviously somebody with an iPhone in the back of the house has done this. So the sound quality is a little distance.
Okay.
This is our guest, Sean Matthey, singing the role of Tamino, just a little bit of it. sounds like we took it off an old 78 from 1912, but that's okay.
It's got that cool kind of sound. I'm just glad it made it to the back row.
That's you, right? That is you.
I'm pretty sure that's me. Yeah.
Now, what were you thinking as you heard it? You were actually going through the words. I watched your lips move.
Yeah, because that was German. And we're singing in English, so yeah, I was just kind of revisiting that a bit, and I was envisioning the dragon that was chasing me in that production.
Yes. Now, how do you make that change? You learn these pieces of music, which are incredibly difficult musically, and difficult to sing, and you learn them in German because that's what it was written in, and suddenly you're presented with the opportunity to do it in English. What does that do to you? How quickly can you adapt to that?
Well, it is. I think you get it into your voice in a certain language, certain vowels, certain consonants, and how those two come together. Initially, then, to change over to English, it's very hard. I think the payoff is the emotional connection you can have once it's in you, singing in your own language.
How close is the English translation to the actual German?
Oh, I think it's very close. For example, my aria, I think it's very well translated, so all the important vowels are still staying the same.
But do you want to go back and do you find yourself, if you're not thinking all the time, potentially singing the next phrase in German?
Uh-huh. That hasn't happened yet.
That'll never happen to these two.
Now, you often use super titles over the stage for translation purposes. Why did you choose to do this in English? Because it's a folk opera?
This is telling tales. We were originally going to perform this opera in German with English dialogue.
Oh, okay.
So we'd do the music in German and all the dialogue in English. And then I went to San Francisco in June and saw the production, and I said, that's not a good idea because the visual elements in this production are so powerful that if we had three artistic elements, the visual, the languages, the dual languages, and the music, I said, that's really going to just throw the audience completely off kilter. So I went back and in about 3 days rewrote all of the language. We're using several versions of the sung English versions, and we're changing it even during rehearsal. But I felt that we needed to have an English translation that could integrate well with the Kaneko production. So to these guys' credit, I think we mailed you the text changes for the music and the dialogue that I rewrote like in July or August, and here we are.
Mm. Now, this is your first time singing in Charlotte with Opera Carolina, Sean, but I know that you have a long-term association stretching back with James Mina, which goes back in time to Toledo, and he actually changed your life.
That's not an exaggeration in any way. I grew up singing. My father's a wonderful tenor, choral conductor, and I just always kind of sang naturally. As a result, I think I wasn't pursuing a singing career. I was actually at Bowling Green State University in the Department of Finance pursuing my degree there and got a letter in the mail from Maestro James Mina from Toledo Opera, who invited me based on the advice of one of the opera patrons there to come and sing for him. He took the time to hear me. He said, I think you're pretty good. I think you need a finishing school. I think you should go to the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia.
And this is with no real training, just singing around the house around your father?
I was singing a lot with my dad. I had a couple of semesters in the formal studio where they were working to teach me how to sing.
And your father's the kind of guy who would just he would announce his presence when he came home.
That's right.
Singing.
When he would come home from a long day's work and he'd walk, he'd very charismatically announce his presence with a tenor cadenza up to high C effortlessly. Yeah, and I would, even from the very young age of 5 or 6, I would run down the stairs rampantly and I would find him and I would look at him and I'd try to imitate him and I'd shake my head to get the vibrato and I'd say, is that it, Dad? Is that it? And he'd pat my head and he'd say, that's good, son.
And then I understand that at age 16, which is when a guy's voice is beginning to mature, I guess, at least you've gone through the vocal change, you did an opera sound for your father and asked him if that was fairly accurate. And he said, yeah.
Yeah, it was an accident. It was a putting together of everything I had heard all those years. And I tried it and something came out. And I said, is that operatic? Is that right? He said, yeah, that's it.
Is your mother or father, are they in music?
No, but they love singing, especially after a few drinks.
Because I've always wondered if Do they sing well after a few drinks?
Oh, they enjoy themselves.
Yeah.
Because I've always wondered if there's a genetic component to this. I mean, because it really the way a person sounds when they sing depends on a lot of different things that are physical in nature that you have no control over, it seems to me. The structure of your face and the cavities in your nasal passages and the structure of your larynx. Is it genetic in any way?
I think there's a genetic link. I think there's a link of osmosis. I was just thrilled by the tenor sound, and I wanted it more and more. And I think that I just let that get in there.
Now you, I'm told, yodel.
That's all part of the story, too. Yeah. I yodeled because my dad took us to Germany when I was a young boy for a year. And we were poor, and we had no money to buy gifts. I had learned how to yodel, so we packed up and went to the Marienplatz in Munich, put the hat out, and did what we could do.
This is why I love opera singers.
Because of the yodel.
No, because you're so surprising. You are the antithesis of what people think you're going to be like.
Thank goodness.
Will you yodel for us?
Well, sure, I'd love to. I mean, it's. Okay. I hope it's a little early. I hope nobody thinks it's a rooster calling people out of bed. But is this ready for me?
Yes, so, absolutely.
I mean, of course, there's the basic pattern that people think of yodel as yodel-dee, but then it gets a little more involved, and you get something like this. That's a little yodel. That's Bavarian style.
I feel like I need a Ricola right now. How do you do that little vocal flip in there?
I was talking with the students about that yesterday at the Country Day School, and it's essentially taking the chest voice up into the falsetto, finding the break, and then just figuring out how to finesse it and make it, and then you turn it into a pattern. Mm-hmm.
One of you talked about the getting it into your voice in the native language and it feeling right, the magic flute. But both of you have talked in interviews that I've read, and other singers that I've talked to have talked about certain kinds of music by certain composers line up with your voice. What does that mean? And I only have a minute left. What does that mean?
Well, I think I wrote about the difference between Puccini and Mozart for my type of voice. I think my voice maybe naturally fits with Puccini music better. However, I take Mozart as my vitamin. Like, I need...
Yes, you called Puccini the meat and potatoes and Mozart...
Right, that's how I feel. Because I need
have no idea what that means.
To sing Mozart on a regular basis to keep my voice in shape. Otherwise, I'll get just obese and vocally too heavy and thick.
Is that because Puccini's all this heavy legato...
Too much freedom, I think.
And then this is Baroque almost, isn't it? I mean, it requires a lot of...
Yes, it's very much in the Baroque classic style.
Do you feel the same way?
I do. I think it's a consideration of timbre, what fits your personality. Uh-huh. I'm very thankful that Mozart wrote these operas, that's for sure.
Sean Mathy plays Tamino. Yuna Lee plays Pamina. James Mina is the general director and principal conductor of Opera Carolina. Their production of The Magic Flute, Mozart's The Magic Flute, plays January 19th, 24th, and 27th at the Belk Theater, and you can get tickets at operacarolina.org. Always a pleasure to talk to you guys. I've never had a yodel on this or any other program, so I feel privileged. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Mike.
When we come back, a whole different kind of art, martial arts. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Pearle Vision, providing annual eye exams, eyewear, and accepting major insurance plans, including iMed Vision Insurance. Details at pearlvisioncharlotte.com. Nobody cares for eyes more than Pearle. And Leap Design, a full-service graphic design studio providing brand identity and design services for businesses and organizations. Details at leapdesign.com. This year's flu season started early and is hitting hard. Diane Rehm and her guests talk about how this flu compares to the previous years and what flu vaccines can and cannot do. That's in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. We are going to continue a look into the martial arts when we come back.
Listen.
The Radio Illusionist plays, or ought to play,
by different rules, ears held through our hypnotic conjuring of associations, memories, inspirations, and ideas.
Listen to me.
Listen.
And then you just turn and you find yourself noticing.
Public radio that plays by different rules. Public Radio Remix from PRX. Saturday, 9 to midnight on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Now on to a completely different kind of art, mixed martial arts. Mixed martial arts, or MMA, is a combat sport that combines kickboxing, amateur wrestling, and submission grappling, all of which takes place in a ring or a cage. The fights are scored by judges, not unlike boxing. It is a sport that's on the rise, with major events rivaling and even surpassing the era of big-time boxing matches. And these matches are taking place here in Charlotte, as well as around the country. We're going to find out more about that right now. Kenny Letts is the founder, CEO, and I'm told pit boss of Fight Lab Promotions here in Charlotte. Welcome to the program. Michael Cornbread Allen is a Fight Lab matchmaker and director of fighter relations, which kind of sounds like an oxymoron, fighter relations, because you're in there to not have a great friendship with these people. And Joseph El Dingo Loco Carroll is a pro MMA fighter and a culinary arts student.
That's
at,
right.
At Johnson and Wales University.
Yes, sir.
Another surprise. In the same chair as the yodeler. He also works as works at a vegetarian restaurant, which proves that Popeye was right. Right?
Right.
Okay. How long has this sport been around, and how long has it been in Charlotte?
You know, early 90s. UFC came out early.
UFC is?
The Ultimate Fighting Championship.
Okay.
They were, I guess before then, Brad, you could speak to that, Pride over in Japan.
Yeah, there were, mixed martial arts. Well, mixed martial arts in its purest, rarest form was actually called pancration back in the early Roman games thousands of years ago, and that sport, sort of took various forms over the generations. In Japan, it was known for years as pancrase, with a different set of rules. You couldn't punch on the ground. In Brazil, they've been doing the Vale Tudo fights for hundreds of years, and in the United States, it's a fairly young sport, like Kenny said, since the early 90s. Mm-hmm. The way it got over into this country was there's a family in Brazil called the Gracies, and they had a martial art that had been passed on to them from some of the Japanese judokas, and it was called jiu-jitsu, Japanese jiu-jitsu.
Mm-hmm.
They took it, they adjusted it because they were men of smaller stature, and they turned it into Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, mm-hmm. per se. And the Gracies, they would compete in these Vale Tudo, no-hold-barred fights in Brazil that would sometimes pack arenas 90,000 deep. This is back in the early 1900s that they were doing this, 1900s, 1920s, right around through there. And the family, they were undefeated, supposedly in hundreds and hundreds of these matches. And over the course of the generations and the years, they eventually made their way to America as far as teaching, like self-defense, teaching stunt doubles, things like that.
So if you had to describe to somebody who had never seen a match,
mm-hmm.
Are they called matches?
Yes.
Okay. If you had to describe it, what would you say? Because when I watched a video of it yesterday, I watched 10 videos of it yesterday, it looked like a free-for-all, but it's not.
No. Not even close.
So explain to me, how would you describe it?
Well, the first thing I would say, sort of like with the opera gentleman later on, he said, what do you need to know about it? Nothing. for mixed martial arts, I would say it in two words: don't blink. Don't blink, because anything can happen.
Controlled chaos.
It's in the United States, it's a very controlled environment. Like you touched on before, there's judges, there's a referee, there's commissions, they have medicals that they have to go through. Mm-hmm. So when you first come to the sport, whether you know anything about it, the first thing you need to understand is that it's not a free-for-all. If you're going there and you're expecting to see two rednecks get in the cage with some chicken coop wire and beat each other to a pulp. It's not going to happen. There's rules. There's regulations. There's a whole lot of things that you can't do.
But it is a combination of boxing.
It's a combination of wrestling. Boxing. Yes. Wrestling, jiu-jitsu, sambo, kickboxing, Muay Thai. If there's a martial art that you can think of, it's probably been integrated into mixed martial arts.
Now, Kenny, I understand that you got involved in this originally as a way to get in shape.
That's right. I've been sitting behind a desk for about 20 years, put on a few pounds, ran into a buddy who introduced me to a friend who used to fight. I'd seen it on TV a little bit, the UFC fights.
Right.
Went in and started doing some boxing and kickboxing, then got into some jiu-jitsu. And then a couple of my friends, we were turning 40. Like a lot of guys turning 40 are.
This was your midlife crisis.
It was the midlife crisis. instead of climbing the mountain, jumping the plane, or going to get a convertible with a 19-year-old girlfriend, we decided to go get in a fight with a 19-year-old kid.
Yeah.
we ran down to Gastonia, and we jumped in what you term an underground fight. And all three of us fought kids that could have been our sons.
Did you win?
You know what? I was winning. I beat the brakes off of this kid. He was He was a good 4 inches taller than me. He was a good 25 pounds heavier. He had a six-pack of muscle. I was still carrying a little bit of a six-pack of beer. I was real proud of how I was doing, and I was thinking in my head, I'm doing really, really – and then it went dark. Yeah. I got knocked out cold.
And after that, I'm told, you had two questions for yourself. How hard could it be –
How hard could it be to pack an arena if it was an open event? We put out posters, and we rented the Grady Cole Center about 6 months after that. And the final statement as we were cheering our beers, we said, okay, let's put some money on the table. How hard could this be?
Yeah.
It's a grind. The second question we were trying to answer was, how do we tell our wives? Because we had gone the forgiveness route rather than permission, and we were actually pretty beat up.
Really? Which leads me to this question with El Dingo Loco, sure. Joe Carroll. As I watched these videos yesterday, this is not child's play. You can get hurt. I mean, you can really – you take a pounding in the ring, don't you?
You can get hurt, but if you put everything you got into it and you do what you're supposed to do what your coaches tell you to do, run the extra miles, do the extra time in the gym, you walk in there knowing that you put everything into it and being prepared, you have to go into it knowing that there's a possibility you're going to get a scrape or a bruise. There's a possibility.
Oh, you're being are you a fighter too, Michael?
I used to fight. I don't
okay.
fight anymore.
But we have
I train the fighters.
But we have three people who have been involved in this, and I'm really curious about the psychology of this because to me it's like a combat soldier. You have to really train yourself not to run in the opposite direction. When somebody's beaten on you, you want to get the heck out of there. It hurts. So what makes you set foot in the cage in the first place?
For me, personally, it's a two-man walk into to a cage. They lock the door behind you, and it's sportsmanship. I don't hate anybody I fight. I don't have any bad intentions against them. I don't want to kill them. I don't want to break their arm off, but they're standing in my way. And I'm going to dismantle them however I see fit. If it's meant that they get knocked out cold or if it's meant that the ref stops it or I snap their arm off, that's their choice. My objective is to walk through them and go on to the next one, as we say in our gym.
In truth, I did a little research into this yesterday. There aren't that many injuries or serious injuries in the matches themselves, but I'm told that most of the injuries come in training.
Yes.
Why?
Yeah, the training is way harder than the fight itself.
But isn't that always the case?
It's always the case, but you're not always talking about getting punched in the eye either.
Right.
It's one thing that, you know, train to – to per se, like they were saying earlier, sing an opera, and it's another thing to do what Joey does, which is step into a cage with another man that means you bodily harm to achieve victory. The training, for example, at our gym, Renegade Fighting Systems here in Charlotte, which is where Joey trains, we're blessed in the sense that we have probably 13 professional MMA fighters and probably another 10 amateur fighters. So our guys are very well prepared when they step into the cage. Very rarely do one of our guys get knocked out or get a serious injury inside the cage. where the injuries occur, like you said, is in training. And when you've got that many talented guys who, let's face it, they're fighters. They don't want to lose, which means they don't want to lose in training either. Now, so, you know, sometimes injuries can occur.
Now, Kenny, you're the founder and the CEO of Fight Lab Promotions, and that's the local fight organization in this sport. Why are they called promotions? They're called promotions all over the country. Why are they called promotions?
Geez, I don't know. I mean, it's just...
They just are.
Yes. It's a, you know, the sport's regulated on a state-by-state basis. So the biggest and the baddest, the most well-known would be the Ultimate Fighting Championship, or the UFC. Mm-hmm. When they come to North Carolina, they have to get a license with the state of North Carolina just like I do. And at the end of the day, we're fight promoters. We've got to handle everything from booking the arena, booking the talent, creating the posters, just distributing, creating the ticket. I mean, every step of it, and leading up to and then post with the venue. And it's just a you know what it is? It's like having a psychiatrist put on a Broadway play. You've got so many different personalities, so many different attitudes that come into it. Yeah. And there's so many little things that can go wrong in the setup and tear down of a show.
You've done these fights at the Grady Cole Center. You've done them at the Epicenter. You've done them at the Convention Center. Your next one is on January 25th at the Music Factory, which is not too far from here. Who comes to see these? What
it's
kinds
a mix.
Of people?
It's a mix. There's, 20s and 30s and 40s ages. We've got a mix of men and women, probably 70% men.
Yeah, that surprised me. You have 30 to 40% women come to these events. Are they coming? Why are they coming?
You know, I've asked them, and they come. Everybody has their own reasons. Some of them come because they train. Maybe they train CrossFit at a gym that has a couple of fighters that are in there getting their strength and conditioning, and they just see how hard these kids work. And they, in some ways, they want to come and see what it's all about. I have a lot of people that come out of curiosity. They get to one show, and the next show they bring two people, and then they bring 10. And it's just... It's captivating. And to answer your question a minute ago, people do it for different reasons. The one big surprise that I hear from every first-timer is, I can't believe the aggressiveness followed by the respect. They're trying to take each other out of the fight. They're trying to knock each other out or submit. As soon as the final bell or as soon as the ref stops it, they immediately show each other a sign of respect. They hug it out. They're smiling. A lot of times they end up training together, trying to help each other get better. And this is immediate. The loser's buying the winner a beer. I mean, and the crowd is into it.
Now, Charlotte used to be the epicenter of professional wrestling.
Yes.
And although they would be loath to admit it, professional wrestling was not real. It was choreographed. It was staged. This is not. This is real.
100%. It is real. It's a real punch. Asked that question. I'll have women call and say, I'm thinking about bringing my son. He's been doing taekwondo or he's been wrestling at his middle school. Is it okay? And I say, sure, we don't have an age limit. But what you need to understand is the fights are real. So when they get punched in the eye, or they get punched in the nose, and it bleeds, they carry on.
We have an email. I was going to ask you about who makes a good candidate, where the fighters come from, and if you wanted to start into this endeavor, how would you do it? And we have an email from Tony. If one is considering a career in MMA, which martial arts are the most beneficial arts to train in? And does the Charlotte area have any fighters that are well-known on a national level? Let's begin with the first question, the most beneficial martial arts to train in.
The answer is simple. There's not one. That's why it's called mixed martial arts.
You need to be well-rounded.
You need to be well-rounded. And before you step in that cage, and this is where my job comes in, because I get several hundreds of phone calls, emails, text messages, Twitter messages, Facebook messages of people asking me if they can get on our card. And I'm very, 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 very cautious about who gets on our card.
Right.
I have young kids that are 18 years old call me, and they've said everything to me from, well, I train in my backyard. I train at the local karate school, which is a legitimate form of martial arts. They've told me that they train with their high school wrestling coach. And then I've heard, well, I've watched The Ultimate Fighter. And, you know, those guys just aren't getting on the show. I mean, they're not getting on our competition. You need to be in a gym training for a good period of time
now,
before you step in that cage.
Less people think that you guys are all, 6 feet 300 pounds or and all muscle, Joseph El Dingo Loco Carroll over here is an unassuming young man. How tall are you?
5'10".
How much do you weigh?
I walk around at 160 and I fight at 145 and 135.
That's me. 160, 5'10". I couldn't do this if my life depended on it.
In 2007, I weighed 210 pounds.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that because you're a chef?
That's because I was in the Navy for 5 years.
So how did you train? How long did you train before you stepped into the thing for the first time?
I got out of the Navy in 2007. And I was like, man, I'm just going to do jiu-jitsu. I'm just going to be a guy that lays on my back and submits people for the rest of my life. And I watched my brother tap out 7 Navy SEALs, and I was like, oh, I think I can do this. And I just got in the gym and started eating salads for breakfast and eating egg whites and eating steak, and my weight just started coming off. I had my first fight. It was 56 seconds, and I've been doing it ever since.
Now, I only have a minute left, but the Ultimate Fighting Championship released a video of their first tournament. On the box, they declared three ways to win: knockout, submission, or death. It also said two men enter, one man leaves. A lot of this is marketing, but it does raise the stakes. How close to the truth is that?
Well, actually, the first UFC, I mean, obviously no one died, or we wouldn't be sitting here. I can promise you that.
Because it's legal and it's regulated.
It's legal and it's regulated and there are rules.
Yeah.
But in the first UFC, there was no time limit. There was no gloves. I think one guy got kicked in the privates, and I mean, it was pretty brutal. We're here now.
We have to stop. But the next bout is on January 25th at the Music Factory, and you'll look for Fight Lab Promotions. Is that right?
FightLabPros.com.
Okay. Kenny Letts, Michael Cornbread Allen, Joseph El Dingo Loco Carroll, thank you. And good luck to you. Stay safe, okay?
Thank you, Mike.